It's not like she's died.
No, but I mean, other things as well. Like when you see a reference to someone like Des O'Connor and no one knows who it is.
I know.
Or Bob Monkhouse.
Bob, oh, rest in peace. Oh,
yeah, rest
Bob.
In peace.
Oh, Bob.
Warning us about bowel conditions beyond the grave. No, it was prostate cancer,
wasn't
it? It was
prostate cancer, yeah, from beyond the grave. That was a bit eerie, that, wasn't it?
That was the point. That's why he'd agreed to allow his estate to do it.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, bless his heart, little Bob. There'll be loads of people like that.
I don't know that Bob Monkhouse was particularly a small person.
No, it's just my brain thinking he's tiny because of the screen.
Little Bob Monkhouse.
Oh, little Bob Monkhouse.
Less than 20 inches tall or my TV's a liar.
Oh, back in the day when tellies were tiny. Yeah. Do you know, I reckon you could fit our, what we called the big TV back in the 90s. I reckon you could fit it in our, the screen size. I bet you could fit it 8 times in the TV we've got downstairs. 6 at the least.
Hey up, I'm Joe Heathcote and this is Consistently Eccentric, a British history podcast where we try to make sense of some of the lesser known and more absurd people and events these islands have produced. So let's get started with this story. Begins on the southern coast of France.
Right, yeah.
In 1731.
Around the time this house was built. Very good.
Although this house was not built on the southern coast of France.
No,
because that would be just, you know, very inefficient then having to cart it all the way here.
It would, but it'd be warmer.
Well, if you manage to capture that southern French heat in the house, sort of vacuum bag it and then transport it up.
Yeah.
Because on October the 10th, in the city of Nice, a little boy called Henry Cavendish was born. His father, Lord Charles, and that's not an affectation, he was made a lord.
Very good.
Was also an MP at the time. However, everyone deserves a little bit of time to relax between parliamentary sessions. And anyway, both Charles and his wife, Lady Anna de Grey,
very nice,
were members of the nobility. So they could do whatever they wanted.
They were nobby.
You know, he was an MP, but that was more of an affectation than a job. It was just something that you had to have on your CV.
Well, somebody needed a Saturday job, didn't they?
Yeah, it was just so he could say, you know, a lot of the nobility of this time, becoming an MP was something you did. It was almost like a gap year.
Yeah, it was a gap year, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I was the MP for, you know, Chipping Norton.
Oh, gap year.
Did you go to Parliament? Twice. Twice I did, yes. Do you know, once I even spoke.
I didn't speak. I fell asleep.
More comfy than you think, those green benches. More comfy than you think.
See, I always think the leather, sweaty. I think sweaty back of leg. And I also think if you fall asleep, you're going to slip off and look like a tit.
Well, hopefully, because I mean, you shouldn't be.
Most of the people in there look like a tit anyway, but go on.
In fact, the Cavendish family were proud of the fact that they could trace their lineage back to a knight who had accompanied William the Conqueror during his invasion of England in 1066.
Goodness me.
So they were old, old nobility by this
point. Did they have any necks? Do they have too many necks?
No, actually, they came away quite unscathed.
Oh, did they? Yeah. Okay, that's all right. Because usually when you get that level of nobility, you get serious inbreeding and they start having three noses and no chins.
To be fair to the Cavendishes, it seems like they cast the net wide when it came to...
Did they
to...
like a bit of rough?
No, no, it was all sort of knobby blood. They wanted to keep it within the nobility, but they cast their net wide in the, you know, when they're going to, what is it, Debrett's?
Oh, yes.
Yes, they were willing to go from A to B in that, A to Z in that book, looking for the next victim. However, despite the fact that they could trace their way back to 1066, he was a minor knight.
Oh.
And it wasn't until the reign of Edward III that the Cavendish family actually reached the highest echelons of society in England.
Oh, right.
When enterprising lawyer Sir John Cavendish was made the Lord Chief Justice of the King's Bench in 1372. And apparently it was quite the promotion, because normally you'd have had to have served in sort of, you know, other high-ranking sort of legal roles at the time. But he just went straight from being basically just a King's Bench lawyer. They were like, oh, there you go, Chief Justice. It's like, oh, okay, I can do that. Rapid promotion. But he made the best of the job.
Right. So how would that work? Why? Why him?
Because apparently he was very popular. Oh, and right. Edward III at the time had a bit of an image problem. So he was happy to promote people who were popular.
Okay.
And kind of go, see, this guy works for me and you like him. And right. he's known for being fair, so...
See, I don't think... I mean, Edward III doesn't ring a bell to me for being massively unpopular. He wasn't like one of the Charleses.
No, no. But all kings go through periods of unpopularity, mainly when they had to raise taxes back then.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like, give us all your money.
Or a Richard. Richards went mental.
Richards. It's funny you should mention that.
Mm.
He continued in this role when Richard II ascended to the throne at the age of only 10.
Yeah.
And he was one of the key people trusted with the suppression of the Peasants' Revolt, led by Wat Tyler.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, Richard at the time wasn't really old enough to be managing the day-to-day of putting down a full-scale revolt, so...
No.
Yeah, it fell to Sir John. Bless him. And... to be fair to John, he also outsourced it because it was apparently his own son who was credited with stabbing Wat to death at Smithfield on June 15th, 1381.
There you go.
Mm. So a Cavendish was responsible for putting down the workers. All to curry favour with the king.
There you go. Mm.
Naturally, though...
I don't know any Cavendishes.
No?
No.
Mark Cavendish? The Manx Missile?
Well, yes, but I meant personally.
No, no.
By knowing people, I mean actually bloody knowing them.
I feel like we know him.
I know of Cavendishes, obviously.
Yeah.
But I don't know any.
Okay, well, we'll find one for you. You can adopt a Cavendish.
I'm not even sure I went to school with one. Again, it's not a particularly northern name.
Maybe that's the thing. I think they were based around Nottinghamshire for the longest time, so I don't think they made it this far north.
No.
They took one look and went, oh no, it looks dirty.
Mm.
We'll stay here.
Grim up north.
We've gone as north as we're willing to go and we're just gonna stay around this area.
Mind you, Nottingham's grim. Mm. It's not my favourite town.
But naturally, having cut off the leader of the rebellions, well, he stabbed him up. I don't think he cut his head off. It made the rebels particularly angry.
Mm-hmm.
And later the same day, reportedly led by a bloke called Jack Straw, though I must point out, not the former Labour Home Secretary and MP for Blackburn, Jack Straw.
Oh.
A completely different Jack Straw. And also, there's queries about whether Jack Straw actually existed or whether it was just a name that was sort of given to some anonymous rebel leader.
I was going to say, is it a bit like... I mean, obviously, there was... a Jack Straw that you've just already mentioned.
He was a Blackburn Rovers fan.
He was indeed, Jack Straw.
Good man yourself.
Good man yourself, Jack Straw. But, like, do you think, like, back in the day it might have been a bit of a name like Joe Bloggs?
Yeah, or John Bull, something that you just used as if people asked who you were and you wanted to remain anonymous.
John Smith.
Yeah, possibly. But anyway, apparently Jack Straw.
Mm-hmm.
He led a sort of mini mob that broke into the Cavendish home,
right,
looking for revenge.
Mm.
They didn't find the Cavendish who had stabbed Wat Tyler, but they did find Sir John Cavendish.
Oh no!
And reportedly, they took the opportunity to, and this is a direct quote, cruelly insult him,
physically or verbally.
Verbally at first.
Okay. Right. Okay.
Like, before we get to the physical violence, you need to read this pamphlet, and then we're going to have some choice words for you, sir.
Mm-hmm. I've written a stern letter.
Before chopping his head off, looting all the valuables, and burning the house down. Strong statement.
Yep.
And you feel that Sir John Cavendish's son, when he found out about this, probably felt a slight twinge of remorse. You know, like if he just hadn't stabbed the bloke himself, maybe that wouldn't have happened to his dad.
Yeah.
But despite this grisly end, Sir John had proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that his family would be loyal to the crown unto even death.
Very good.
Mm. Always something that, you know, the king will look for.
Mm-hmm.
Are you willing to die for me?
Mm.
Yes? okay, I'm going to keep you around.
Mm-hmm.
It secured them a place at the top end of society for the next 600 or so years.
That's a long time to be in the upper echelons of high society.
Isn't it just? They were all over the place.
But that, to me, also means that they managed to... Nobody embezzled a massive amount of wealth there because they were they managed to hold water for 600 years.
Oh, they held their money remarkably well.
You know what I mean? It's like you... like.
We'll get into it, but they were good with money. Oh, yes.
Yeah, but I mean, you always hear of the story. It's just like they held on to the money, everything was fine.
Well, and then there was the nephew,
and
then there was the, who picked it up.
I don't know, the kind of the bastard son of some bloke that came in, and because that he was literally the only son and heirs.
Yeah, he was the last one left.
He didn't give a shit, and he just literally pissed it all up the walls. I mean, that's you hear it time and time and time and time again.
Well,
it was our Prince Regent that was one for doing that. He did that, didn't he? Our Prince Regent. He was a bit of one for spending money, wasn't he?
Was he?
He was.
Never heard that. This is and revelation.
There was a local one in... because I'm originally from Lytham St Anne's. There's a local one from Lytham St Anne's who did something very similar.
Mm. Was it gambling? Was it drugs?
It was gambling, drugs, drink,
oh, it was
women.
All...
It was a bit of everything.
He ticked off everything on the bingo card.
Yeah.
Of wastrel.
He got a full house of wastrel there.
Oh, good.
See, he was a bit of one of that. He got rid of all the...
In hindsight, they shouldn't have called him wastrel. That was just...
It was poor planning, really, on their part, as a parent.
Waste, for short.
It's like, how many times do you get people whose name fits their job description?
Well, that's literally how names used to work.
Yeah, I know that's how it used to work, but now you get, you know, Mr. Payne the dentist and things like that. Have you never... Did you never see in St. Anne's Mr. Payne the dentist?
I did not see Mr. Payne the dentist. I'm surprised he had any... dentistry. Beggars can't be choosers.
No, he was a private dentist, Mr. Payne. P-A-Y-N-E, Payne.
Oh, he tried to cover it up well.
But yeah, but I mean, how many... there's loads.
I love the fact that you're like, it fits the job. Yeah, you went straight to Payne.
It fits their job. It makes sense. There's so many names like that.
You're going to be Mr. Dickhead the politician. You know, it all makes sense.
Yeah. I'm not going to follow that up with anymore because my brain's not working
anyway,
enough. Go on.
Back to Lord Charles.
Oh, yes.
And his young son, Henry. Yeah.
Yeah.
As well as being an MP,
mm-hmm.
Charles was a keen amateur scientist. Because weren't they all around this period?
No, I thought they dabbled in something else.
No, amateur scientist.
Amateur science, right. Okay.
He was a member of the Royal Society, naturally, and would eventually rise to the position of Vice President of the Royal Society.
I thought they were all naturalists.
That was science at the time.
Yeah, I'll take that.
Yeah.
I'll take naturalists. Naturalists and politicians, the upper echelons.
Not naturists,
not the same thing. They didn't get the bollocks. Well, they might have got the bollocks out, who knows.
Mm.
Have you watched Saltburn?
No,
me neither.
Not going to.
But apparently, there's a lot of that goes on.
Oh, really?
Something about bathwater, but I don't want to get into that.
Ugh. Unfortunately, he was also going to become a single parent.
Oh.
As 3 months after the birth of their second son, Frederick, Lady Anne de Grey died. So she got an infection and the complications just kept going. It was a long, drawn-out death caused by childbirth.
That's horrible. That's horrible. Frederick, that's the name that's dying out. You don't get many of them.
Mm.
You get Freds and Freddies, but not Fredericks.
Henry was not quite 2 years old at this point.
Oh.
Now, I know it's sad.
It is sad.
But there is a positive in that it turned out that relative to the times, Lord Charles was a very good father.
Mm.
He doted on his two sons and he paid for the finest private tutors to give Henry the best education that money could buy. And the Cavendishes were very rich, so that was one hell of an education he was paying for.
Mm-hmm.
All while keeping Henry at home, away from the ruffians and other boys who might upset his his sensibilities and his sensitive nature.
I mean, it's not completely unheard of that you get good dads historically, and I don't like the narrative necessarily that it's just like, oh well, you know, you get these stoic fathers that just aren't involved, but I don't think it was the norm, and I think that's why, unfortunately, as dads you all get tarred with the same brush. But it does half annoy me. Really annoy. It annoys me now because you know that it's not as cut and dry as that.
No, I'm just giving Lord Charles props and saying,
yeah, snaps.
He kept Henry and Frederick at home. He made sure that they were being looked after well. I mean, he spent time with them. He tried to enthuse them in, you know, the things that he was enthusiastic about.
It shouldn't be shocking. Science. It shouldn't be shocking that he didn't just ship them off to some school million miles away, is it? It shouldn't be like that, but it, you know, there you are.
Well, from a young age, it was noticed that Henry preferred the company of adults to fellow children. And he was always interested in the experiments that his father was doing with electricity and various interesting chemicals.
Ooh.
Yeah, who wouldn't be? However, at the age of 11, his father decided it was probably time to send Charles to get a more formal education.
Oh, no, he's off to boarding school.
At the age of 11, he's off to boarding school.
Secondary, then.
Secondary, yeah. It is reported that Lord Charles first considered sending Henry to Eton.
Oh, God.
However, at the time, it was reportedly full of sexual promiscuity and indecent behaviours.
Still is.
I couldn't comment, but at that point, apparently it was.
Well,
they've definitely cleaned it up these days.
Right,
look at the quality of people it's producing.
Look at the quality of David Cameron.
Well, it didn't sound like the kind of place that would fit in with Henry's personality.
Right.
Instead, it was decided to send him to a private school in Hackney called Dr. Newcombe's School, for it was run by Dr. Newcombe.
Very good.
He was good at education, very bad at branding. This was a small school with an intake of only 100 boys, all of whom were full-time boarders, so you didn't get any day boys. If you were going to Dr. Newcombe's school, you were going to Dr. Newcombe's school. You were getting the full Newcombe experience.
Is it a bit like Jennings?
If you want to think of it like that, yes. Only instead of getting up to hijinks, Henry was following all the rules very strictly. He was spending most of his time alone reading, and he was very uncomfortable in any situation where he was expected to speak.
So he was Derbyshire, not Jennings.
I don't know enough about the books, so I'll have to say yes.
Okay.
Because you do know enough about the books.
Yeah. There is, for those who don't know what on earth I'm on about, there are a collection of very, very, very old books by a bloke whose name is eluding me currently. But they are about a little boy. It's not just William. He's called, well, his second name is Jennings, and it's about him and his friends at boarding school. And they are brilliant. Anthony Bookeridge. There you go.
Yeah, I just pulled an author called Anthony Bookeridge. What do you do? I write Bookeridges.
Bookeridges. I just pulled that one out of absolutely nowhere. But that's how my brain works.
And I send them off to my friend William Publishershire. And they get sent out to the shops.
Oh, if you stopped. Right. So Jennings is the main character in these books, and Derbyshire's his best friend. But Derbyshire's very shy and very bookish, and really doesn't want to get up to the hijinks and be in trouble. And he's very sheepish, but he always ends up having...
involved.
Yeah.
They always do.
They always do. But they're very good books, and if you can get a copy of any of them, I'd suggest you read them, especially the first one. It's absolutely riotous.
Henry, he stayed at the school until the age of 18, when he went directly to Cambridge University.
Oh, goodness.
To continue his studies.
Not Oxford.
No. And this decision was made in no small part due to the fact that Sir Isaac Newton had studied at Cambridge around 80 years earlier, before becoming a regular lecturer. Indeed, Henry would have the benefit of being taught by a number of the professors who had themselves attended lectures given by Newton. So he's only one generation removed.
Wow.
And his dad. to be fair, Lord Charles was a bit of a Newton fanboy. He was very much around Newtonian physics. And he's like, no. My son shall go to Cambridge, for that is where they make Isaac Newtons. And my son can be an Isaac Newton.
Not a Jimmy Neutron, an Isaac Newton.
Yes, my son will be the next Isaac Newton. God damn. So, yeah, this is like in the wake of all of Newton's sort of new theories.
Yeah.
Cambridge was really kind of throwing itself behind that. And like, this is where the place to go for the new sciences. If you want to be on the cutting edge of scientific research, you come to us. If you want to do dowdy old classics and that kind of
dusty
boring,
old books in a dusty old library.
Why don't you go to Oxford? That's more your speed. We're young, we're dynamic, we're hip, we're Cambridge.
I don't know anyone who went to Cambridge. I know a couple of people who went to Oxford, but...
Get you. Henry opted against attending Trinity College, where Newton had been. It was far too popular a college, with too many people around. It was too people-y, by far, for Henry.
Do you know what? I'm right with him. Mm. The world's too people-y. To do with about half the amount, to be honest.
Instead, he chose to attend Peterhouse College, which at the time had around 40 students at once.
That was the top number. That perfect.
You know, it oscillated between maybe 30 to 40 students, but that was the entire college.
If I'm going to be honest, there's about 39 too many people in that particular... Mm. Yeah.
Well, it was a small enough intake that it meant that Henry would be able to avoid almost all human contact.
Good.
And focus on his studies, which was the thing that really interested him.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, are you there for the hygiene curry? I mean, he probably engaged in some socialising, but under heavy, heavy duress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like, oh, this is the worst part of uni.
Probably turned up to things with a face like Cillian Murphy.
Mm.
Just
I'm not into this.
Absolute disdain.
Constantly checking his pocket watching it. Well, that's 9 o'clock, lads. I'm off to read a few chapters before bed.
Mm-hmm.
Henry left Cambridge in February 1753 with a very solid grounding in mathematics, Latin and modern scientific thought. What he didn't have, however, was a degree.
Oh, you didn't get his degree?
Nope.
Why?
Because the kids of nobility... generally, at the time, didn't see the point of going through the stress of the examinations when they knew that having an official qualification, it wasn't going to impact on their lives in the slightest. So these were the guys who were going to be introduced to the business leaders who were friends of their father, and it would be, oh, yes, he went up to Oxford, or, oh, he went up to Cambridge, he's a good sort.
Mm.
Nobody ever asked, well, did he get a degree? It was enough to know...
You went.
Yeah, you're the son of the right person. You went to a good school, mm-hmm. and then you went up to Oxford or Cambridge and you studied hard,
mm-hmm.
and you're a dependable sort. So why put... If you knew you were going to get a job regardless, a good job, why would you put yourself through the stress of the exam?
To know that you could actually do it.
Okay. That's a good reason. A lot of people chose against it.
I understand that, but for me... You see, my life comes with receipts. You know this. If I say something, it's because I have everything there to back up what I'm saying.
But in this day and age, the important receipt was the birth certificate. It's like, do you know my father? Was a genuine, oh, okay, yeah, we'll get
your
position.
But you can't guarantee that that's going to be enough further down the line. That would be my fear.
Today you can't. Back then, you definitely could. Also... It's 1730s. What the hell are you doing at university, you female? Get the hell to a kitchen.
No, I have forced myself to grow a moustache.
Oh, well done.
By sheer willpower alone, and possibly some hormones, I have pushed out a little goatee, moustache and beard.
Okay.
I have fashioned my hair manly.
Have you? Okay.
I have tied down my bosom.
You've strapped it down.
Strapped it down.
Inserted a sock into one's codpiece and
away I go.
Fair enough.
I'm a very tiny, tiny man.
Much like me. While he didn't get a degree, while Henry was at Cambridge, he did leave his first piece of published writing.
Right.
It was a poem marking the death of Frederick, the Prince of Wales. It's a very sad event. So lots of people felt that they had to mark it in some way. And being young and sort of impressionable, Henry thought, everyone seems to be writing a poem. I shall write one. His poem is terrible.
Yeah, well, I feel for him. All my poems are absolutely abhorrent.
However, it does contain one line, which I quite like.
Go on.
While nature may mock us, it does lay bare hidden causes and the wandering paths of the stars. Sounds nice and deep. I thought that was a nice line.
Yeah, it sounds like something the GCSE teacher would pick apart, doesn't it?
But he's trying, is what I'm saying
he's
here.
He's trying.
But it does point to the fact that, you know, he's tending towards the scientific.
Mm-hmm.
It does lay bare hidden causes. That's what he wants to do. He wants to find the bare hidden causes of nature.
Mm-hmm.
When he left Cambridge, he moved back in with his dad, Charles.
Aww.
Because he liked the fact that Charles organised his routine for him and that he didn't really have to think about things beyond reading and assisting in the experiments that Charles was getting on with.
Mm-hmm.
He began accompanying his father to the Royal Society meetings and the dinners hosted weekly by the Royal Society Club. Henry was made a full member in 1760, and from that point on, he didn't ever miss a dinner if he could help it. You could probably count for the rest of his life on one hand the amount of these dinners that he missed.
Wow.
He never travelled. He stayed in London his entire life from this point.
Amazing.
And every week, rain or shine, you would find him in his accustomed place at the Royal Society dinner.
I know exactly why you've picked this person for me.
Do you?
Yeah.
Why?
Because he's autistic.
We have no evidence to state that he's autistic.
Right.
Nobody did an AQ 10 with this lad.
I don't need to.
Okay. Well, we'll see if you continue to feel this way as we move through
story.
I
very, very, very much do. I very much do. As a fellow autistic, it's quite obvious why you've picked this chap for me. Because I'm sympathising on every level, to be perfectly honest. Do I like people? No. No, I don't.
In fact, the Royal Society dinners were pretty much the only social activity that Henry Cavendish would actually engage with.
There it is.
The rest of his time was spent either in scientific study or running practical experiments.
Yeah.
Henry Cavendish loved nothing more than a highly specialised and minutely calibrated scientific instrument. Nothing got him more excited.
Yeah, it's like me with my paintbrushes. Oh, God, I love a good paintbrush.
You know, the
mate.
More specialised, the
Jesus.
Better. If you could say this instrument has one specific purpose, and it's so niche, you will only ever use this piece of equipment once, but it took 10 years to design and build, he would be in hog heaven with that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this interest and expertise in the use of scientific instruments that led to him being chosen to head a committee to review the Royal Society's meteorological instruments and to help assess the instruments of the Royal Greenwich Observatory.
Oh, nice. Mm. Yeah.
So he was the one who was going there and giving them a coat of looking and saying, well, this could be improved. I like what you've done there, but have you considered, you know, we've upgraded the lenses since then.
I disagree with his approach there. Yeah. I disagree with his approach. I don't believe that that's how he'd approach that.
What do you think he'd do?
I think he'd go in and go, nope. Is this good? No. No, it's not.
This is suboptimal. We're going to replace it. No, we need to talk about what it needs replacing. It's suboptimal.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to... Come on.
Mm-hmm.
We can do better than this.
Well, you know how I get when you put the wrong thing in the wrong place in the fridge. No. No, move it now. No. No, that's not okay.
Yeah, the fun bit of the way you do it is you don't tell me where the correct place is, so I just keep moving it. It's like a game of hotter, colder. Based on how angry your face looks. Until eventually I get a little grin. It's like, oh, good.
There it is.
Then I realise I've still got to put the cheese back in it. So the sweaty hands.
Yeah, so that I disagree with that approach completely. Mm. That's not the approach. Mm.
When he decided to sort of come out into the scientific community proper.
Mm. Come out as a scientist.
He came out swinging.
Okay.
He published his first paper,
mm-hmm.
Factitious Airs, in 1766, in which he described how he'd been able to produce a peculiar and highly inflammable gas, which he referred to as inflammable air, by experimenting with acid being poured onto different metals. So this was the fun time of scientific experiment. It was the Wild West kind of time where there was so much unknown that you just did things and then just recorded the results. You know, that kind of, ooh, ooh, that's interesting.
What is this?
Yeah.
So there is, I remember doing a scientific experiment at secondary school where they used some kind of metal.
Right.
And they did add an acid.
Mm.
And they did create a gas, and then you can light it. But I cannot remember for the life of me what that is.
Well, the gas that he'd discovered how to produce just turned out to be hydrogen.
Mm.
You know, the fundamental building block of the universe, really, which comprises around 75% of all matter.
Mm.
So this was, at the age of 35, quite a landmark discovery.
Mm.
He discovered and described the gas that can, you know, constitutes 75% of all known matter.
Mm.
That's a big get. Henry, though, he did not rest on his laurels.
Mm.
You know, you'd just be like, I'm the hydrogen guy.
No.
Periodic table number one? That's me. I did that.
Well, yeah, I get that, but also no, because...
Oh, he's found that now.
He's found that now.
Hmm.
Bored now.
What's next?
What's next now?
Well, do you want to know what's next?
Yeah, go on, what did he do next?
He was willing to support the Royal Society in any way that they asked him. If there was a question that needed answering, or something that needed supervising or organising, they could always ask Henry, because he loved the Society.
So he was a people pleaser.
A little bit of a people pleaser in certain ways.
In certain circles. Mm. In the right bubble.
Well, he served on a variety of committees, covering a massive range of scientific topics. These included the Committee for the Transit of Venus, 1769.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that is measuring as it moves across the night sky and not a plan to put Venus in the back of a transit van and, you know, take it for study.
Yes, I
think they were measuring things rather than trying to influence
probably with using that great big telescope.
The great big one. Well, he'd already made sure that they had the finest lenses attached to that thing. So
yeah. He's already fine-tuned all the twiddly knobs. And
he just wants to follow through on that earlier piece of work.
Mm-hmm.
The Committee on the Gravitational Attraction of the Mountains in 1774.
I didn't even know they had gravitational attraction.
Well, they have mass.
So does this one. Hello, Thursday next. Does she have gravitational pull?
It's tiny, but it's there, yes.
It's tiny, and it's hairy, and she's dense. Hello, Thursday.
Yes. The problem is, I believe I have gravitational mass that pulls Thursday towards me, which is why she's here now. But yeah,
hello,
so there was an entire committee trying to figure out exactly what the gravitational attraction of mountains might be influencing in terms of natural processes.
Mm.
Which is interesting. Down you go. No, okay.
Onto mummies.
Onto you.
There
right,
we
well.
Go. The thing is with... Beg pardon, Thursdays.
The Committee for the Scientific Instructions for Constantine Phipps' expedition in search of the North Pole and the Northwest Passage.
Mm-hmm.
In 1773 as well.
Mm-hmm.
So he's covering Arctic exploration, he's covering astronomy, he's covering physics, and of course, you know, up until this point, most of his work's been in chemistry.
Mm.
So he's just everywhere.
He's just dibble-dabbling.
If you need
now.
A guy who's got a bit of knowledge and will quickly learn on the go and become an expert, you go to Henry Cavendish.
Mm-hmm.
In 1773, Henry joined his father as an elected trustee of the British Museum.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, this provided him with even more opportunities to deepen his scientific learning, and he threw his energy into this alongside his committees and his regular evenings at the Royal Society dinners.
Oh, he likes his din-dins.
He was 42, and he developed for himself an insular routine that kept him as happy as could be. So you'd find him, if he's not doing an experiment, he's probably down the British Museum looking through some of the more niche curio cabinets.
And if he's not there, is it dinner time? Because you know where he is.
Is it dinner time on Tuesday?
Is he having his dinner?
It was within this routine that Henry Cavendish began a series of experiments with gases. You're going to get chucked out now, Thursday. You ruin everything. And you know it. You know that's what you're doing.
You're hurting her feelings.
I'll come and see you afterwards. You know what happens.
No, she wants you now.
Sit there then. Sit there and grump at me. It was within this routine that Henry Cavendish began a series of experiments with gases. In 1777, he was able to prove that when animals exhale, the gas that is released is carbon dioxide. Although at this time it was known as fixed air.
Oh, okay.
He then began experimenting with acids and alkalis to make samples of various gases, including carbon dioxide, which he then measured in various ways, such as specific gravity and the much more exciting sounding combustibility. So he's coming up with his own table of gases.
I understand. I mean, this is fascinating, but like, because my brain doesn't work that way. My brain is completely artistic.
No, autistic.
And autistic. Yeah. We've made that joke between ourselves many a time. It is both, as we found out. I can't even begin to understand how he came to any of these conclusions and created any of these experiments, apart from just poking things till something happened.
It's very purposeful and very detailed poking of things.
Yeah.
I did try watching some YouTube videos about some of these discoveries that he made.
Yeah.
And the people explaining them were very earnest, and there were lots of diagrams. Mm-hmm. And I got to the end of it and I was like, well, those were some science words.
Yeah.
And I've got to trust you that they made sense, because to me, not sure. I will describe an experiment to you in a bit and I will do my best. I've simplified it to the point where I feel like I kind of understand what happened.
Okay, your very best layman-ish.
Yeah, because it's very complicated stuff, all of it.
Oh, God. So are we talking Ladybird Book of Science? Because if it's not, then I'm going to struggle.
The problem is, if you wanted to talk to Henry Cavendish about this... Mm. He would try earnestly, probably really excited that someone wants to talk about his experiments. Mm-hmm. And then he would see that there was no sort of light of understanding in our eyes.
No.
And would quickly become bored with us because we wouldn't be able to add to the topic or, you know, spark anything else off. We'd just be there going, Ooh. Yeah. And it's...
Yeah, I do that too. I don't mean to do it, but I do.
Mm. It's okay. I mean, he wouldn't be rude about it. He'd just be like, first chance he got to excuse himself, he'd be off back to do his experiments. The result of all this experimentation that he was doing with gases, though, was a paper called General Considerations on Acids, which won him the Royal Society's Copley Medal, the highest honour that the Society could award to a member.
Oh, well done himself.
So he hadn't got that for discovering hydrogen, but his... No.
Dabbling.
Yeah, his dabbling with various gases. They were like, this is amazing. This man is the king of gas. He is the gas master.
He's the gas master.
Everything was going perfectly for Henry, is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
At this point in his life, everything's tip-top.
Good.
There are no problems. Everything is smooth sailing for Henry. And so long as nothing changes, he is going to be happy as Larry for the rest of his life.
I feel like something is about to change that is going to rock the boat, baby.
In 1780, his father died.
Oh, Jesus, that'll do it.
The man he'd lived with for, like 30-odd, 40 years.
Yeah. Well, you said before he was 42, so...
Yeah, He'd lived with him a long time at this point.
Yeah.
Because there'd just been that brief hiatus for schooling, all the rest of...
But I imagine, like, you know, for holes and stuff, he'd come home. Because boarders tend to go home for, like, Christmas, Easter.
Oh, yeah. He wasn't going anywhere else. As far as I know, he never went on a holiday. And exactly. I count, you know, like, Wales as a holiday destination. He never went to Cornwall.
No.
You know, it was, I am going to stay in London. Thank you very much. Without the stabilising and reassuring presence of his dad, Henry began to retreat more and more away from any socialising, to the point that, aside from seeing family members occasionally, his only public appearances were at the Royal Society functions because he couldn't give those up.
Mm-hmm.
He forced himself to go to those things. But everything else was just cut off. No. Becoming a recluse was made even easier for Henry because when his father died, he received not one, but two fortunes. One from both his mother and his father's side.
Mm-hmm.
So he was immediately made. It's like, oh, you're emotionally broken. Well, we're going to take this mourning period and we're going to give you all of the money. So please feel free to indulge in whatever impulsive life decision this grief is forcing you into.
Oh, Jesus Christ, what's he going to buy?
Well, it wasn't just a fortune. It meant that he was suddenly amongst the wealthiest people in the entire country. He was like suddenly one of the top 10 people when it came to cash in all of England.
Wow.
In fact, at the time, he was described as the richest of all the savants and the most knowledgeable of the rich.
Right.
Henry used a small amount of this money to buy a house on Clapham Common, mm-hmm. which he kitted out as a bespoke gentleman's laboratory, with no thought at all as to how it would actually work as a place to live. He had so many books that he had to have his library in a separate detached building. The entire upper floor and lawn were for housing all of his telescopes and associated instruments for astronomical observation, while his drawing room was a laboratory complete with a forge in an adjoining room. And I'm assuming the smallest cubby had a little trundle bed, which is where he'd spend 6 hours before he's up again.
I just think he'd have one of those, what do they call them, fold down beds? Murphy bed.
A Murphy bed.
Yeah.
Like in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, I imagine he'd have a Murphy bed.
Yeah. Just pulls it down, sleep, and then just throw it up.
Yeah.
And away again.
In his book room. There we go.
Yeah. I fall asleep with a book.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wake up and I'm immediately back in the zone.
Mm-hmm. What would you spend yours on?
What?
Mine would be teddy bears, cats and art supplies.
What? Unlimited
and
money?
And clothes.
Unlimited money?
Yeah. Clothes. All the clothes.
Yeah.
But I'm not talking about us now. I'm us in his position.
What would I spend it on?
Yeah.
In his position.
Yeah, mine would be clothes. Clothes, art supplies, cats and teddy bears.
I like to think I'd suddenly become a patron of the arts and I'd be sort of self-financing theatres and reviews.
No, I'd go completely.
Do you know what I'd really get into? Newspapers and pamphlets. This was the time of the pamphlet. I'd be producing pamphlets by mm-hmm. the freaking bucket load.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime someone slighted me, there would be an angry pamphlet coming out in that evening.
Would you be supplement man?
I would, yes. the Georgian version of a podcast.
Yeah.
Read my pamphlet.
Yeah. One through every door.
Yeah. Just paying people. You will be posting my pamphlets to who? It doesn't matter.
Everyone.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Just taking up all the printing presses in London, printing my own personal fan fiction and pamphlets. There we go.
Going back to the days of the beer. Are we after or before the days of the beers? You know, when we did the great beer flood.
I think we're just predating that, but we're getting into that area.
Because I'm just thinking
the Georgian period was sort of like a boom time for beer.
Because I'm just thinking you're. Pure
I'd own a brewery.
Yeah, your pure love for beer. I think you'd also invest heavy in that. What episode is that, by the way?
I can't remember off the top
of my
head.
Dear
you know,
listeners,
I don't have them all indexed in my brain box.
No, dear listeners, we do have an
episode,
the London beer flood, where we talk. Well, Joe talks at me all things beer. I don't drink, so.
You just feel sorry for the people who died.
I just feel sorry for the people who died in the flood. But there you go. If you want to learn about it,
I bring the beer knowledge, you bring the empathy for the human condition.
I do.
It works. The one nod to personal comfort that Henry provided himself with.
Did he get a dog?
Oh, no.
Did he get a cat?
No.
Oh. Has he got a horse?
He doesn't have an animal companion of any kind. That requires too much independent sort of, you know, you've got to worry about where it is. A book will stay where it is. A finely calibrated scientific instrument will do what you want. A cat will knock that finely calibrated scientific instrument on the floor and then
yeah, okay, I'll
whip
give
its
him...
hoof in the air and start licking.
Yeah, cats don't give a shit.
No, the one thing he did to make his life more comfortable was to build a private staircase for his own use at the back of the house. This was so that he would never have to actually see the female housekeeper, as he was reportedly deathly afraid of having to talk to women. If he needed to communicate with female staff, he would do so via notes that he would leave around the house.
Yeah, but you can see where that's come from.
He's never had
a female influence in his life.
Nope.
Not at all.
Especially at boys' boarding school, you wouldn't have, you know, you might have a matron, but she'd be scary as all balls.
Yes.
You know, you wouldn't, you know, it's not exactly a loving kind of like, yes, you can talk to them, yes, they're really approachable kind of relationship. It'd be scary.
And if we're going to put a modern day lens on it, he comes across as someone who was completely asexual. There was never any intimate relationship described by anyone involved in his life. He had a few friends who were basically people who were on his level scientifically, who he could talk to about that.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, he kind of would tolerate family, I guess.
Yeah, because they're family.
Yeah, that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, he didn't see the point of people much at all.
No, I am slightly better than that sometimes.
Luckily for Henry, though, the Royal Society still had a no-girls policy, so he was able to keep his weekly appointment at the Society dinner throughout all of this.
Oh, very good.
Despite having constructed his own personal scientific heaven,
mm-hmm.
Henry stopped producing any published works.
Oh.
This may have been simply because he gained joy from finding things out for himself and genuinely didn't see the purpose beyond this.
Yeah.
Or it may have been that he was too anxious to place himself in a position where people may ask him questions, or worse yet, ask him to present his findings.
Possibly, or it's just having to communicate.
And it's having to organise all of those thoughts into a way of communicating that to someone written. Mm. You know, he's got scribbled notes and he's like, I know what that means. Look at what I found out. That's brilliant. And I imagine that then sparked five more questions that he just immediately set out to answer.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, why would I waste time explaining this to people when I could be getting that answer?
I'm already five questions ahead of where you're reading, so
I it's not for me to get you to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
Either you keep up or you fall behind.
Mm.
What he needed, though, to help overcome this communication obstacle was a new surrogate father figure, someone who could be his liaison with the rest of the world. He needs a valet, essentially, is what he needs.
He needs a gentleman's gentleman.
He needs a gentleman's gentleman, yes. In the summer of 1783, when he had agreed, under duress, much duress, to have his cousins round for breakfast, Henry was shocked to see that they had brought a friend.
Oh, no, that's
not an outsider.
No, that's not all right. That's poor show, that's
it
not...
would have been poor show, but this friend was Charles Blagden, a doctor and former army officer who had served during the American War of Independence.
Wow, okay. Mm.
So he'd recently been all the way over in America fighting a losing battle against the Patriots, as most NFL teams did during the 2000s. Henry remembered that he had actually contacted Charles Blagden before. He'd sent some letters during one of his committee roles a few years earlier, asking Charles, while he was on the boat going across, if he wouldn't mind taking some temperature readings of both the ocean and the air temperature at various points across the Atlantic.
Oh, right. So I suppose initial shock, but having realised who he is, actually, this might be a beneficial
social situation. So I'm annoyed that they brought someone, but this is someone I've at least corresponded with via letter.
Yes.
And it was someone who was interested in the work I was doing with the committee and agreed to send the readings. And as far as I know, Charles Blagden did dutifully do all of the recordings that he'd been asked to because he desperately wanted to be part of this scientific community.
Mm.
The problem was Charles Blagden wasn't born into nobility, so he had to get a day job, which unfortunately is an army surgeon. They were like, well, the current war's over there.
Yeah.
On the other side of the Atlantic.
Off you go, old bean.
Do I have to? Well, that's kind of what the army is.
Mm.
Yeah. If we tell you to go.
Off you trot.
Off you pop. So, yeah. What Charles Blagden wanted more than anything was to be accepted by the scientific community in London. And what you'll find is, actually, he probably already done more than enough, because before he'd gone off to war, he'd already conducted valuable research into the human thermoregulation.
All right.
Being the first person to make the link between sweating and temperature in 1775. So he'd already done some really important work. But again, because he was not from the upper class, you know, that hadn't been enough to secure him his place in the Royal Society.
Oh, no.
He did eventually get let in, but it was more through being associated with Henry.
I was just going to say, I bet it was association, yeah.
The two men, realising that they were both scientific pioneers, they quickly struck up a friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And before long, Henry had replaced one Charles with a younger model. Blagden became an assistant, mm-hmm. not only in scientific experimentation, but also in navigating the world, which mainly consisted of keeping it as far away from Henry as was possible.
Fair enough.
With a new assistant, Henry was able to begin publishing research again. And in 1874, he published findings from experiments he had conducted in March of 1873, which proved that he had identified the chemical composition of water as H2O. So two parts of his inflammable gas.
My God.
To one part oxygen. Unfortunately, in the interim, between him conducting the experiment and him having somebody, you know, help him get the wherewithal to publish it, another scientist called James Watt had come to the same conclusion and claimed the discovery for himself.
Oh.
The argument around which of the two men actually worked it out continues to this day. And there's actually a third name thrown in there, but I'm trying not to confuse things too much.
That's insane.
So it does sound like a lame argument. It's like, well, I did it last year, I just hadn't got round to telling anyone about it.
Yeah.
But in Henry Cavendish's case, it was completely true.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, I had other things on. And actually,
I wasn't in a good place mentally.
Yeah. So, go away. Well, he wouldn't have said any of this, of course.
No.
He'd have asked Blagden to write a strongly worded letter.
Mm-hmm. And a pamphlet.
What is without a doubt, though, is that when Cavendish's methods were reported to a French scientist called Anton Lavoisier, he decided he didn't like Cavendish's deflogin... Right, this is a hard word, okay?
Go on then.
Deflogistinization. Deflogistinization theory as to how the water had been created.
Right.
This theory was based on a belief, an erroneous belief as it turned out, in the existence of a fire-like element called phlogiston, which was contained within combustible bodies and released during combustion. So that's how they explained the way that matter changed.
Right.
Was based on various levels of this phlogiston.
Mm-hmm.
This rejection of the phlogiston theory led Lavoisier to establish the concept of chemical reactions, an event now known as the Chemical Revolution, or the birth of modern-day chemistry.
Wow.
And that all came from him looking at Henry Cavendish's work and going, I'm not arguing with your conclusion.
I don't like your method.
I don't like how you're describing it worked, so let's see if there's something that makes a bit more sense.
Mm-hmm.
So he inadvertently was the spark that led to...
modern day chemistry.
Yeah.
So he's the bloke you need to thank then in your chemistry class.
Definitely thank Lavoisier. He was the guy who made the leap, but the little grain of sand in his brain box that got him thinking about it was Henry Cavendish. He was the irritant that caused this great leap forwards when it came to chemistry. It would be, we can't claim the revolution of modern day chemistry from the French just based on the fact that Cavendish had made a bit of a boob.
Mm-hmm.
However, today, Cavendish is probably best known for an experiment that bears his name, though ironically, it's one of the few that he didn't actually come up with.
Mm.
It was instead a man called John Mitchell, who was more than just an amateur astronomer, and was probably best described as an amateur proto-astrophysicist in terms of his interests.
Gosh, right, okay.
Around the time that Henry Cavendish was working out the composition of water, John Mitchell was predicting the existence of black holes.
That's all they seem to be doing.
But that's quite a mental leap.
Astrophysicists. That's all they seem to do is black holes.
Yes, this is the guy who first posited their existence.
Right. Well, they've not moved on much.
Stating thusly, if there should really exist in nature any bodies whose density is not less than that of the sun and whose diameters are more than 500 times the diameter of the sun, since their light could not arrive at us, or if there should exist any other bodies of somewhat smaller size which are not naturally luminous, of the existence of bodies under either of these circumstances we could have no information from sight. Yet if any other luminous body should happen to revolve around them, we might still perhaps from the motions of these revolving bodies infer the existence of the central ones with some degree of probability, as this might afford a clue to some of the apparent irregularities of the revolving bodies, which would not easily be explicable in any other hypothesis. But, as the consequences of such supposition are very obvious, and the consideration of them somewhat besides my present purpose, I shall not prosecute them any further. So it's basically saying there is if you have an object that is that much bigger than a sun, based on their idea of how light travelled and how fast it was, the gravity of that object would be so great that the light itself would not be able to travel fast enough to leave it. So he's basically describing a black hole. And he was doing this, you know, hundreds of years before they were established as a thing. And he was like, yes, but I'm working on something else right now, so I shan't follow this thought through any further. It's just enough to note it. I'll let somebody else pick that up.
I have absolutely no idea what you're on about.
He was the first person to describe a black hole. Very good. I may have over-egged the pudding on that one.
Yeah. Well, I hope somebody out there understood what the bloody hell you were talking about, because you lost me about a sentence and a half in.
I'll bring you back. Because the two men knew each other well from the Royal Society, okay, John and Henry.
Mm-hmm.
So it was likely that Henry Cavendish was aware that John was in the process of designing a machine that would allow him to weigh the earth. As you do.
I'm not disputing the fact that he might be doing that.
Yes.
My brain can't contemplate how that's possible. But it doesn't mean that it can't be possible, and it doesn't mean that it hasn't been done. I just wouldn't know where to start.
And neither would I, but it's not a set of weighing scales the size of a planet, don't worry.
Well, no, because they have to be on the planet, so they can't be bigger than the planet. But I don't even know how you'd...
I'll explain it. Don't worry.
No, my brain hurts. This is getting too in-depth.
Because
now,
when I say weigh the Earth, what I mean is it was designed to work out the mass of the Earth. However, sadly for John, just as he was putting the finishing touches to the experiment, he died on April 21st, 1793. Knowing that Henry was one of the few people in England with the understanding of precision equipment who would be able to conduct the experiment, John made sure that all the equipment was packed in boxes and sent to Cavendish's home on Clapham Common. And I bequeath unto you, my good friend Henry,
this epic piece of kit. Good luck.
You'll enjoy it.
Godspeed.
Cavendish was so excited that he had a special building constructed to house the equipment. Mainly because he realised that the gravitational field produced by his own body would be enough to throw the entire thing off. This is how sensitive the experiment is. He also adjusted the room to eliminate temperature variations and air currents, so it could be a perfectly clean space for this experiment to take place in. The experiment worked by placing 2 1-kilogram lead balls at the ends of a 6-foot rod, which was suspended horizontally by a torsion cable attached to the centre. And a torsion cable is a cable that when you spin it, the resistance is a known torque, so you know how much force it puts into resisting any turn.
Right. For this, I mean, the rest of the story, fabulous. This is one of those bits where I think you need to discuss this with the listeners, not me.
Oh, are you checking out here?
I'm mentally checking out of this. This is painful.
So that's the first part of the setup. Larger lead balls were then placed beside each of the smaller ones, causing a minute gravitational attraction that led to the rod turning clockwise by the most minuscule of amounts against the torsion rod. By measuring the rod's movement, Cavendish was able to calculate the force exerted by each of the large balls on the 1-kilogram balls. And from these calculations, he was able to provide an accurate estimate of the gravitational constant, and thus the mass and the average density of the Earth.
I'm really glad for him.
It was a big thing.
Yeah.
Of course, the gravitational constant, I believe, has now been broken, because that's where the non-sort of Newtonian physics takes over, where you get to places with such extreme gravity that these constants break down. But at this point, this is a groundbreaking thing to have worked out.
If you say so.
Cavendish found that the Earth's average density is 5.48 times greater than that of water. And what's extraordinary about the experiment was that the way that Cavendish had eliminated every source of potential influence and error and every factor that could possibly disturb it, he'd managed to measure such a small attraction. It was 1/50 millionth of the weight of the lead balls. The result that Cavendish obtained for the density of the Earth was within 1% of the current accepted figure.
My God.
So using 4 balls in a specially constructed shed with a rod, he'd managed to work out the weight of the Earth to within 1% of what we've sort of worked it out as today with all modern scientific technology that's available to us.
See, this is what I'm talking about. This is such a specialist mind.
Mm. And John knew, he's like, if I send this experiment to literally anyone else, they're going to fuck it up.
Yeah.
They're not going to consider everything. He's going to see what I'm trying to do, and he's going to be able to execute.
Mm.
Cavendish gave Mitchell full credit for his accomplishment, though this was ignored, and Cavendish became something of a celebrity, which he hated. So locals would point to the shed and say, that's where Mr. Cavendish weighed the earth. And everyone was like, oh, this is amazing, because they didn't understand how he'd done it.
No.
But it sounds impressive.
It does sound
this
impressive.
This man managed to weigh the earth. And you're like, he's some kind of god.
Is he a magician?
He what must be. This? And he hated the notoriety.
Oh, I bet.
Because it's like people wanted to ask him how he'd done it. Mm. And he's thinking, much like you were thinking then, and I was thinking when I was reading it, he's like, I'm not going to be able to explain this to you in a way that you're going to understand.
No.
And
not even a little bit.
Yeah. So I will answer your questions and you will feel you haven't gotten an answer. So you'll be upset.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be upset because I've had to talk to you. So no one wins in this scenario.
No.
Just leave me alone. It's enough to know that I've done it
mm-hmm.
and that we can use that information now moving forwards. You don't need to know. Do not look behind the curtain and do not ask me
mm-hmm.
how I did it.
Mm-hmm.
Even at his weekly Royal Society dinners, Cavendish got to the point where he would try to avoid any conversation. Unless it was one-to-one and it was on a topic that was interesting to him at the time. So definitely not the weighing the earth experiment.
Mm-mm.
When he was not interested, the exchanges were described thusly. The person who sought his views would find themselves speaking as if into a vacancy. If their remarks were worthy, they might receive a mumbled reply. But more often than not, they would hear a peeved squeak and turn to find an actual vacancy and the sight of Cavendish fleeing to find a more peaceful corner. I love the idea of a peeved squeak. Just had enough. And off he goes.
And away.
Yeah. Find the table in the corner with one chair.
Just facing the wall. Yeah. Just like, ugh.
This fame also led to Cavendish doubling down on secrecy from then on.
Mm.
Meaning that he made a whole raft of scientific discoveries that he never told anyone about, for fear that people might actually want to talk to him about them.
Mm-hmm.
After his death, when his notebooks were being reviewed, evidence was found that, amongst other things, he had either discovered or anticipated Richter's law of reciprocal proportions, Ohm's law, Dalton's law of partial pressures, principles of electrical conductivity, including Coulomb's law, and Charles's law of gases. So just by him being so achingly sort of embarrassed in any social situation and so avoidant of anywhere where he had to interact, scientific advancement was probably set back by a couple of decades because he found all of these things out, hadn't told anyone, and we had to wait for other people to make the same discoveries in order to move things forward.
Because he ain't blabbing, he ain't saying nout.
But possibly the most impressive one, he'd written part of a paper called A Mechanical Theory of Heat, which is the only known 18th century work that predicted the concept of thermodynamics. So he was way, way ahead of his time.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's evident.
Mm. Though there may have been many, many more, which he either threw in the bin or never even bothered writing down. You know, it's like he discovered something, he went, well, I know that.
Mm.
It's in my brain box.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the next thing, because I have this house of wonder where I can do any scientific experiment that takes my fancy.
Mm-hmm.
Why would I sit there and, you know, praise myself over something that's now in the past?
Mm-hmm.
I'm moving forwards. Henry Cavendish saw the 19th century dawn and spent a further decade living in almost complete isolation as one of the richest men in Britain. And to put it into perspective as to how rich he was by this point, he was the single biggest depositor in the Bank of England at the turn of the century.
Oh, wow.
If he decided on a whim to remove all of his money, he could literally have bankrupted the country. That's how rich we're talking. And he went out once a week for a slap-up meal.
Yeah.
Apparently as well, his fashion didn't change from the point at which his dad died. So he'd be wearing old-style frock coats and thinks he was anachronistic in his own lifetime.
I love that.
You know, he would go out and he would dress formally. He'd be dressed to the nines. It'd just be a style 50 years out of date.
And what's wrong with that?
Nothing's wrong with that. But I'm saying it's just like, well, now no one's advising me on this. I'm not interested in it. This is my smart outfit. This is the outfit. I like to think it was the same outfit each week.
Mm. And then he'd... I've had it cleaned.
Yeah, he'd leave it somewhere and leave a note. Mm-hmm. Please clean. And be like, we know, Mr. Cavendish, we've mm-hmm. cleaned this same frock coat once mm-hmm. a week for the past 30 years now. Mm-hmm. He died, as most men do,
yep.
on February 24th, 1810, at the age of 78. Potentially having never spoken to a woman throughout his entire life who was not a direct relation.
Wow.
He is buried, along with a number of other Cavendishes, in the grounds of Derby Cathedral, if you ever want to go and visit.
No.
Such was his contribution to a whole swathe of scientific understanding that when a new laboratory was being built at Cambridge University in 1874, it was decided to name it not after Sir Isaac Newton, but after Henry Cavendish.
Oh, that's lovely.
And the Cavendish Laboratory still stands to this day.
That's lovely.
Though it probably didn't hurt that the Chancellor at the time just so happened to be called William Cavendish and was a relation.
Oh, no, but that's nice. I like that.
Mm. So that is your story. The source, the life of the Honourable Henry Cavendish by George Wilson, which was written in 1851.
Well, I really enjoyed that. I liked him a lot. And why did you pick him for me?
I picked him for you because I thought you would chime with a lot of his feelings on peopliness.
Why is that, Joe?
Because you don't like peopling.
No, I don't.
Unless it's on your terms and with a clear exit strategy.
Absolutely. People within my own bubble.
Yeah,
is grand.
We're okay.
We're grand.
I like to consider myself as part of your bubbler.
Yeah.
Part of your buble.
My buble. But no, outside my bubble, no.
You can sod off.
No, I'm not interested.
But yeah, I just like the story of this man who is like, if you give me an enabling situation, which he had, because mm-hmm. he was rich enough to create an enabling situation, he absolutely flew. You know, his peers all saw him as a step above. And that's why he was noted as always attending these dinners, because that was the only chance that people had. And it was almost like at holding court, you had to go and try and talk to him, and he would only talk to you if what you said sparked his interest and was worthy of his time.
Yeah.
And
that's recognition enough. He spoke to you.
Yeah. But at the same time, you imagine that if he was born in the situation of, his assistant, Charles...
Mm.
He'd have been considered an imbecile. Because the world, he would have been forced to be in a peoply world. He wouldn't have been able to separate himself and he wouldn't have coped with it.
No.
So, how many people who could have done the things that he did we lose?
Yeah.
Because they were born into the wrong social strata and weren't able to have this. Or didn't have a dad who understood, because his dad clearly understood and was like, no, come home. Mm-hmm. We'll do the scientific experiments together. I'll make sure you've got the connections and I'll introduce you and get you these positions that I know you'll like.
How much greatness has been quashed by a lack of understanding of people's...
needs.
Differing needs.
Yeah, well, it's not even needs, just people's different ways of looking at the world, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's all it was. He saw things that... it made perfect sense to him. And you sit there and go, what?
Mm-hmm.
He weighed what now?
I completely love that he did that, and I'm really, really, really glad he did, for reasons that I don't really know why. I don't know why I'm glad he did, but I'm glad he did, and that's great. But I am not going to sit here and pretend I know anything
about how he did it.
About how,
apparently, annoyingly, he did make a rounding error when he wrote it up. So he'd done everything else was impeccable. The equations were all perfect. He'd worked it all out. He'd run the experiment with a degree. Apparently, in order to get the results, because they were so minute, he had a small hole in the side of the building because he had to observe it from outside, and he had a high-powered telescope that he was using to look to do the measurements. But he'd done all of that, and then right at the very end, because he was probably already thinking about the next experiment, there was a rounding error in the paper that had to be sort of... someone picked it through and found it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you take out just this minor error, it was so accurate as to be scary.
Mm.
But there you go. So That is Henry Cavendish.
I like him.
A gentleman scientist who would prefer if you didn't call.
Yeah.
And just left him to his gentleman science.
Left him alone.
Yeah.
I like him still.
I may produce a pamphlet, but please don't ask me about it.
Mm.
Okay, so what are you going to do with your evening now? Scientific inquiry, no doubt?
Probably.
Probably. No worries. Well, goodbye, everybody. Em's already taken the headphones off. She's already away.
I'm gone now.
That's her. That's her leaving now.
I'm done. Bye-bye.
She's away there. She's out from the chair.
Yeah, I'm going.
Bye then.
That's me.
Lonely now.
Pogo's touching my Linus.
I choose not to give any context to that.
Hi there, it's Emma, Chief Organiser at Consistently Eccentric, here to remind you all that if you like what you hear, you can catch up with all previous episodes and session series by searching for us on Acast, Spotify and iTunes. How fancy. You can also join us on Instagram at Consistently Eccentric Podcast, where we update on the weekly episode and post all of our bonus content for you lucky lot. See you next week.